So we're picking up chapter 11, verse 11. We're going to read the whole thing, and then we'll start to walk through the text together. If you are looking at an ESV Bible, it might say Gentiles grafted in, and we'll get to that illustration this morning. Paul begins with a question. So I ask, did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. Now, if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? Now, I'm speaking to you Gentiles, and as I am an apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry in order somehow to make my fellow Jews jealous and thus save some of them. For the rejection means the reconciliation of the world. What will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? If the dough offered as the first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. But as some of the branches were broken off, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant toward the branches. If you are, remember, it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. Then you will say, branches were broken off so that I may be grafted in. That is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand that fast through faith. So do not become proud, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. Note the kindness and the severity of God, severity towards those who have fallen, but God's kindness to you, provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. And even if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again. For if you were cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted, contrary to nature, into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these, the natural branches, be grafted back in to their own olive tree? May God bless the reading of his word. Now, I just want to give you a caution as we study this, much like we did last week. Anytime we read about Israel, there's a couple potential responses we can have towards it. We could have the same kind of responses that I think we'd have at maybe what would be an awkward family reunion. And how many of you have ever done that? You've gone to a family reunion, somebody else's family, and you're like, this is awkward. I'm not enjoying this. And I could think back into high school, dating a girl, they were all Catholic, did not enjoy a family reunion, was totally out of place at their family reunion. Then I remember going to a wedding. It was really much like a family reunion with Jess's family for the first time. We're just dating, and I just want to say, think Goodfellas. Think the Godfather. And so rather than being like, you know, I don't belong here, I was kind of fascinated. Like, I wanted to know all these stories. And there are a lot of guys there that did some less than savory things in their past. And one of the gentlemen I met, I mean, he walked up to me, real big guy. He had a suit jacket on and a turtleneck. And just big old Italian guy, pinky ring, and I went to shake his hand, and he grabbed me by my ears and kissed me on both cheeks and then patted me on my face and said, I got to make my rounds. I'm thinking, holy cow. It sent a shiver up my spine. And so my reaction to that was pure fascination. Tell me what he used to do. Did he whack anybody? I mean, all kinds of stuff. Can I get a favor from him before we go? You know, things like that. And I think those are two potential responses we could have as we walk into a text where it's highlighting Israel. It's like we're either fascinated or, you know what, it's awkward. It's an awkward family thing. I'm not a part of the family. I'm on the Gentile side. I'm not a Jew. And that could be the way that we react. And here's what I want to tell you. Don't be so quick to dismiss anything in the Bible to do with the Jews. Last week we learned through the way God has kept his promises to Israel that he'll keep his promises to us. He's faithful. He sticks with his word. And so right away, as we got to verses 1 and worked our way through, there's a couple things that Paul put forth as evidence that, hey, just because Israel's rejected God doesn't mean that he's broken his promises to him. The first piece of evidence, he's like, look, I'm like the Jew of Jews. I was a Pharisee. I kept the law. I was perfect. I was from the favored tribe. I was, got all my stars on the chart in Sunday school. He was that guy. And he said, look, the fact that I, who used to be so zealous for Jewish religion and then turned to Jesus, is evidence that God is keeping his promises to Israel. Then he put forth another promise. He said, there's always a remnant. There's always a faithful remnant throughout history of believing Jews that love Jesus and worship Jesus. And so I think when we move forward through this, because remember the divine outline, chapters 9, 10, and 11. You had chapter 9 was Israel's past. Chapter 10 was the present. And now we're dealing with the future a little bit. And Stephen, when he comes next week, is going to deal with that even more. And if I could summarize last week, those first 10 verses, God keeps his promises. He kept them to Israel. He'll keep them to us. But here's what's going to happen this week, and I need you to stay with me as we move through this text. We're kind of going a little bit deeper down a theological rabbit hole. So I need you to hang on a little bit, and we're going to understand the fact that while Israel has been set aside in a partial way, it was done for the salvation of the Gentiles, the non-Jews. See, when you look at biblical culture, a couple things will stand out. They only really talk about two races, the Jews and the Gentiles. So it's everybody that was Jewish was the chosen race, Gentiles, everybody else. But really, when Jesus steps on the scene and the Christians come to faith in the New Testament, it really only became about two people groups, those that love and honor Jesus and those that haven't accepted the gospel. So we need to keep that in mind. There's no place for preferential treatment based on any ethnic division. And I just want to say that that has no place in God's kingdom. Now, let me tell you just some interesting facts about the Jewish people. Currently, there's 9 million people in Israel, maybe about 9,300,000, give or take. Only 30,000 of them are believers today. Only 30,000. That's 0.2% of the population. So we would say they're still in that period where they're set aside and there's a faithful remnant there preaching the gospel, and they pray for their people. And you may have seen the programs, pray for the peace of Jerusalem, pray for them to turn back to Jesus. Now, we got to understand, they're an amazing race. Their impact on human history is pretty spectacular when you consider they're currently, their landmass is the size of like New Jersey. I've been to Jersey, nothing impressive there, not the size of it, not anything else. Maybe the beach occasionally, but that's what you're dealing with, a nation about that size. And just here's one of the things we find. They've kind of preserved some very important things through history. They preserved this idea of monotheism. That means the worship of one God. All around them, the Greek and the Roman cultures, and even some of the cultures that lived really in close proximity to them, the Egyptians, were all about a polytheistic mindset. And if they hadn't, been resilient, chosen by God, we might have lost the concept of monotheism. We worship one God, and we owe them for that and for our heritage. But the other thing, too, they've done a lot of spectacular things. You could see their impact in the medical field, their impact in collecting of Nobel Prizes. Between 1901 and 2022, that tiny group of people won 22% of all the Nobel Prizes. That's amazing. And so what I want to leave you with is, if you're ever doubting, is there a God? Can I believe that there's a God? Just know there's this nation that everybody seems to hate that has survived 4,000 years going strong as a people group. Now, I'll say this. That doesn't mean we give them a blank check for everything they do. Because let's be honest, we live in our country, and there's no way we're writing a blank check to what our government does. But we recognize that God has his hand on them, and we don't want to bring any room into our hearts for any anti-Semitism as believers in Jesus. They've been a huge part of world history, and they are more than just a part of the history of Christianity. In fact, even though they're temporarily set aside, he has a plan for their future inclusion. So Israel as a nation has stumbled in their faith, but I want you to get this point. They are not lost forever. It's important that we approach this text that way. There are streams of theology out there. One of them is called replacement theology, that God has replaced Israel with the church. I believe a text like this helps us to open our eyes and see that God has a plan for the church and a plan for future Israel. So with that in mind, I want to bring you to two spiritual insights and then two applications, and pretty much we're just going to walk through the text. So the first insight I want you to pay attention to this morning is that God's plan for Israel includes the salvation of the Gentiles. Look at verse 11 again. So he asks this question. Again, he's moving forward with his rhetorical style, asking a question that he's really not looking for an answer to because he's writing, and then he gives his own answer. He asks, did they stumble in order that they might fall? Now, what I want you to see in that first phrase are these two words, stumble and fall. Stumbling is losing your footing. You can stumble, you can trip over something. Do that a lot in the house. I remember when I was going through, you know, growing pains, stubbed my toe a lot. And it didn't mean I fell. Sometimes I regained my footing. And so he's asking, are they being set aside for now because they're going to fall, which is a metaphor for being lost forever? He's raising the question, does this mean, because they've rejected Jesus now, that the nation will always reject him? And look at the answer he gives. This phrase we have talked about over and over again. He used it back in verse 1. He used it all through the book of Romans. It's the strongest negative reaction to a question. He says, by no means. Some translations say certainly not. You know, think of the strongest way you would say no. A kid asks you to do something, certainly not. No way. Forget about it if you're with my wife's family. Rather, though, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Now look at this phrase, so as to make Israel jealous. It's like, so God's plan all along was just to make them jealous? Because we would say, based on the Ten Commandments, jealousy, a sin, bad thing. Is it always a sin, though? I think really, when we break down what jealousy is, what you're saying is, if you're jealous of someone, you're saying, you're in my place. Let me tell you a time where I think jealousy would be totally fine. Date night. I show up, we try to have date nights, my wife and I, and I show up and dude shows up and she gets in his car. I'm going to be jealous, possibly murderous. But think about the relationship between God and his people. He had chosen Israel, and think about how all the things that God has done through them. Paul talks about the prophecies, the patriarchs, the law. It was all given to them, and they were his chosen people. And think all the way back to Abraham. God said, your offspring will be a blessing to the nations. And so Jesus comes. They reject Jesus. And they're, all of a sudden, God sets them aside because guys like Paul, they go into ministry and he gets frustrated at the Jewish response. He's like, look, I'm going to the Gentiles now. God told me my ministry is now with the non-Jews. And it says too, through their trespass, salvation has come, to the Gentiles. What was their trespass? It was ultimately rejecting Jesus and trusting righteousness that they had based on following the Jewish law. Now, we would call that religion in our day. And here's what happens a lot of times. If we're not careful, religion gets in the way of Jesus. Religious practice gets in the way of Jesus. I was talking to a guy who planted a church, and they got a new drummer in, and one of the older gentlemen was really unhappy with this new drummer. And what's crazy is the former pastor of that church also doesn't really care for the drums, but he comes with earplugs during the music. And here's what he said to my friend who started this church. He said, I would rather bring earplugs and be a little uncomfortable with the music and see a church full of young people than to have the music I want and the church be dying and not reaching anybody. I thought, man, that is awesome. He's repented of his religion. He recognizes the goal is to make disciples and see people come. And right now, if you're looking at any of the statistics that are out there, they're predicting a lot of churches are gonna close within the next 5 years, and it will be devastating, the impact. So what we tend to forget is we have our desires to do religious practice, and sometimes we need to repent of that when it gets in the way of Jesus. Preachers love to tell people to repent of their sin. Religious people hate to hear, repent of your religion, especially if it keeps you from God. So at this point, we're looking at this text, and it's like God is saying through Paul, hey, we want to make you Jews jealous so that you'll come to Jesus. And it's like, well, was that the idea all along? Well, Genesis chapter 12, verse 3 says this, talk God speaking to Abraham, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So God's not like delving out punitive. He prophesied a long time ago, and saving the Jewish race included saving the whole world. So think about it this way, and this is how one pastor states it. If the Lord has used Israel's great transgression to bless the Gentile world, how much more will he bless the world when Israel turns to him in faith and the glorious millennial kingdom comes? There's a lot of people that read about the millennium in Revelation. They're like, well, that's symbolic. Well, we believe here at Bridge that we take the Bible at its word. It says 1,000 years. We believe it's going to be 1,000 years. And that time will be ushered in by the Jews turning back to Jesus. Now look at verse 13 and 14. He said, now I'm speaking to you Gentiles. And as much then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry. Meaning he brags about his ministry. He puts a spotlight on his ministry. He's excited about his ministry. He talks to all his friends about his ministry. He writes about his ministry. And he's hoping that by doing that and saying, hey, the God of the Old Testament that prophesied Jesus through the prophets, Gentiles are turning to him, that maybe some Jews will get it and come to faith in Christ. That's his goal. Second spiritual insight. God's plan for the Jews includes salvation of many. So tying verse 14 back into this insight, the idea of someone's in my place, and then verse 15, for their rejection means the reconciliation of the world. What will the acceptance mean but life from the dead? So the entire world from any nation is reconciled to God. Now, here's what I want you to understand about the Christian faith. It is the most inclusive and exclusive faith in the entire world. You don't have to be a certain, you know, skin tone. You don't have to be born from a certain ethnicity or nation. You don't have to speak a certain language. The Christian faith is multilingual. It's on every continent. Everyone is invited. All they have to do is turn to Jesus Christ. But it's exclusive in this way, where other religions say, hey, you can earn your way. You can do the things. You can practice religious practices to get to God. Jesus says, no one is good. No one can earn their way. And if you try to earn favor with God, if you try to earn salvation, you are excluded. So it's a very narrow road to get to Jesus, but all are invited. So the rejection of the Jews means the entire world can come to Jesus. And it was prophesied about that. And there's even signs of this in the Old Testament. Do you know there's a lot of stories in the Old Testament that include non-Jewish people? I mean, let's just talk about Jesus' family tree for a moment. You go back in his family tree, first of all, there's about 5 women included in there, and some of them are scandalous, even though they're Jewish, but there's people like Ruth, who ended up being King David's grandmother. She was not a Jew. She followed her mother-in-law home, and God blessed her with a Jewish husband, and she was grafted in to Jesus' family tree. It's an amazing story. You see stories like with the prophet Elisha, a gentleman named Naaman. He was a brilliant military commander. He comes and is healed of leprosy, and you could tell his heart is turned towards the one true God. And we said, when I bow at the temple, I will be bowing to your God. So we've seen evidence that hey, maybe faith is more than just for the Jewish people. And then you jump into the New Testament, and Jesus even makes statements like this, that I'm going to move beyond what's happening in Israel, or, you know, Israel's going to reject me and the Lord's going to bring many into the fold. Now, moving into Revelation 7, chapter 4, there it talks about this future mystery of Israel, where it gives this number about 144,000 people sealed. This is looking towards the future. In fact, one of the things that I was like shocked when I got into this part of Romans is, yeah, it's future based. Yeah, we're talking about the nation of Israel, but also at the same time, we're seeing an eschatological thing happening here. And so what happens is when 144,000 Jews come to Jesus, and again, as a kid, this is the picture I had in my head. They're all just doing their thing in Israel, and then something happens, they're saved, and then they start jumping on planes and taking walks and all kinds of things like that. It's because I didn't know a lot back then. Here's the reality. The true Jewish people are scattered throughout the world. And when they get sealed by God and they come to Jesus, I believe wherever they're at, they're going to be a blessing and they're going to share the gospel and they're going to say, hey, the king is coming. And it talks about a great multitude after the 144,000 that are sealed come to know Jesus. So think about this for a moment. If the Jews all of a sudden, you see Jewish, ethnic Jewish people turning to Jesus, turning away from the sacrifices and all the rituals, and they're saying, we want to love, honor, and follow Jesus, and we want to tell people about Jesus, I think that is a sign that Christ's return is not far off. Because when you get to Revelation 7, and again, religions take this text the wrong way. They started a religion, so we get to 144,000, we're good. And then they got past 144,000, had to change some things that they were saying, so they were completely inaccurate. But we believe that, they're going to be a blessing and lead to the salvation of many. Look at verse 16. It says, if the dough offered as first fruits, what in the world is that? Well, it's talking about the dough offering. Now, in our church, we have a dough offering. It's very different. In fact, that's how we worship God, is through our money. But what this is talking about specifically ties into Numbers chapter 15, verses 19 through 21. All of Israel was called to give a first grain. In this case, it was a dough. It says, if the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. Well, listen to what Numbers 15, 19 says. And when you eat of the bread of the land, you shall present a contribution to the Lord. Of the first of your dough, you shall present a loaf as a contribution, like a contribution from the threshing floor, so shall you present it. Some of the first of your dough you shall give to the Lord as a contribution throughout your generations. This is the picture of the first fruit offering. And he's saying, if the little lump that was given is holy, then so is the rest of the bunch. And so the rest of the loaf is considered consecrated or considered holy, because you're giving back to God a portion of what he's given to you, recognizing that, hey, I know you gave this to me. I know it's all yours to begin with, and I'm going to do my best to honor you with it. And then it goes on to say, and if the root is holy, so are the branches. Talking about olive trees, which we're going to get to. So we're going to turn to our first application. And here's the first point. And this is for you and me, because we're the Gentiles that are talking about it. Humbly, you were grafted into this faith. You were grafted into this tradition. You were grafted in to the patriarchs, to the ones that God made the promise to in the Old Testament. We're now grafted into that family. It's kind of like, and I tell people jokingly, I'm an honorary Italian, even though I'm Hungarian, Irish, and German, and probably everything else in Europe, for all I know. I'm saying, because I married my wife, and she's like, no, you're not. She's like, you just wish you were. You're like, well, absolutely. But by marriage, I associate with a very Italian family. Thank Godfather. Because of Jesus, we're grafted in, because the intimate relationship we have with God because of him is even greater and more powerful than a marriage. But look at what he says in verse 17. And this is what took place. But as some of the branches were broken off, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant towards the branches. In a general sense, we should have humility, because our salvation is all based on God's sovereign grace and God's sovereign choice. But in another sense, we need to have humility towards the people of Israel, even the ones that don't worship Jesus. Now, look at this phrase, nourishing root of the olive tree. It's a metaphor for the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They are kind of the stump that this has all been built upon. But when you think about olive trees, back in ancient culture, olive trees were very important. They could live for hundreds of years. They got their olive oil from it. They got olives from it. What would happen was there would be a branch that would stop bearing fruit. They would chop it off and throw it into the fire. And so what they would look to do is find a healthy olive branch, and we'll look at this in a moment. They grafted them back in, and we're the ones that are grafted in. And look at how it describes us, that we are a wild olive shoot, meaning we weren't part of the chosen one. We weren't part of olive trees that were curated. We were some olive tree out in the wild that God went and said, that one's mine, and I'm grafting it back into this healthy tree. It's almost like a dad who had these kids, and the kids rejected him, and he's like, I'm going to go get new kids to make these other kids jealous. The new kids are going to take their place, and they're now a part of the family. That's what grafting in means. And so we have this nourishing root that is the patriarchs from the Old Testament. Second application is this. God receives the faithful and rejects the unbelieving. you're here today, this is a good time to take a mental checklist. Are you faithful? Are you faithfully following Jesus? Not just are you here at church once in a while. Are you doing the stuff that God has called you to do? Are you obeying his word? Are you living a holy and separate life from the world, which is, I get it, really tough to do. But we need to be careful that we live a believing life all the way to the end. Look at verse 19. Then you will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. And Paul says in verse 20, that is true. And he gives the reason they were broken off. It was because of their unbelief. But you, and he gives this, stand fast through your faith. Stand fast through faith, I should say. That means stay grounded in what you know to be true. Stay grounded and stick close to Jesus. And then he goes on to say, so do not become proud, but fear. You ever think pride is a problem among Christians? I think it's one of the most deadly things we can slip into. It can happen because of position. It can happen because of knowledge. It can happen because of church affiliation. It can happen because we have a Christian heritage in our family. All these things can lead us to this idea of pride that we think we're better than others. I had a lot of lessons to learn when I got married. It's like letting my wife finish her sentence, not assuming that I know what she's going to say. Because doing that is a sign of pride. Sitting with an unbeliever and wanting to cut them off and not let them tell me their story, or trying to answer a question before they get it all out, that's a sign of pride. We don't want to become arrogant. Thinking I'm not going to fall into sin and I don't have to guard my life and guard my decisions, that's a sign of pride. We need to have a measure of fear. In fact, the word tells us in Philippians, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Come to God with a lot of humility and let him teach you through his word. Look at verse 21. He gives us warning. So for if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. This is what drives me crazy about certain pockets of Christians in America. I was having this conversation with an older gentleman from my past. And we're talking about this idea of maybe pending persecution coming to the church. He says, well, that's not going to happen. This is America. I'm like, it's happened all through history. Do you think we're better than the, well, no. It's like, it sounds like you do. And so we just need to be so careful. We need to realize that, you know, we're a nation for what, 240-ish years? Israel's been a nation. Israel's been an ethnic group for over 4,000 years. And God has dealt with them severely for their sin. Verse 22, note then the kindness and the severity of God. He's very kind. He's very loving. He wants us to be with him, but he's also severe. He means what he says in his word. His severity is towards those that have fallen. His kindness is towards those that are faithful. And then he says, but God's kindness to you provided you continue in his kindness. Over the past couple months, I've seen a lot of people seemingly just walk away from their faith, deny biblical truth, look you in the eye and just seem not to care. And it's like, I fear for them. I pray that they're saved because they're not acting like they're saved. They're not continuing in the kindness of God. They're not continuing in being obedient to his word. In fact, when they've been confronted, they've fluffed off the truth. And as a pastor, that breaks your heart. You say, I don't want to see them end up punishing or perishing. But not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, I know that's about false teachers, but you may have a time in your life where you love Jesus, you seem to be on fire from him, and then you just walk away. If you walk away and come back, that means you've been saved, and you're truly his follower. Because people do fall, people do make decisions, people do slip into sin, I get that. But then there are also other people. There are people that look like they have it all together, and then they just go away. And what does John say about them? He said, they went out from us because they weren't truly from us. They weren't part of the faith. Verse 23, and even if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again, talking about Israel. For if you were cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these, the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? Got a couple pictures I want to show you coming up on the next slide. Here you see a couple weird looking tree things going on. The first one on the right is like, I didn't know that really worked. I've seen people do that, thought it was trying to save a tree and it didn't happen. Those are olive branches. You see the healthy branches being put back into a healthy stump. And what they do is they bind these things and wrap them together. And if you look at the bottom picture, that's what a healthy stump with two new branches grafted into them look like. And then you see up in the top left, them putting a wild branch next to a natural branch. But this is what it means to be grafted in. And all through the Middle East, there are trees that look like that because they take very seriously that olive tree industry. And when they have a healthy stump and they have they try to revive it with healthy branches. And that's a picture of what happened with the Gentiles being grafted in. Looking tree there, that we are these branches that God brought in and said, hey, there's a healthy stump here. That's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all the teachings of the Old Testament. The other branches have been cut off and set aside for now. And then the Gentiles came to faith. And what God is saying here is there's going to be a future where even those branches that were cut off can be re-grafted in. Talking about the nation, not necessarily about individuals. If God can cut off Israel for unbelief and faithlessness, he can cut us off as well. If God can graft us back in, or graft us in, he can graft them back in as well. But here's what I want to end with, and I want you to think about this as we get ready to enter into communion. Your faithfulness is the measure of the genuineness of your faith. If you're like, I want to be genuinely a follower of Jesus, how do I communicate to others? Or just have genuine faith. And be faithful in the little things. I love it when people say to me, what am I supposed to do for the kingdom? It's like, what's the next thing, the next obedient thing in front of you? And, you know, it could be something like, they need help with first impressions team. I don't want to do that. Well, you're asking how to be obedient, and I'm giving you something, and you're throwing it back in my face. You know, being obedient, discovering God's will, is being the next decision you have to make, that you have a decision that shows you're either for him or against him. Your faithfulness is the measure. Not your heritage, not your traditions, not your religion or anything else. Your faithfulness to Jesus Christ, to keeping his word, to proclaiming the gospel and making disciples, that answers the question, is my faith genuine? The last question I want to answer or ask you this today so that you can think about it as we prepare for communion is this simple question. Is Jesus Lord of your life? This morning as you sit here, as we talk about this ancient historical nation that had all the good stuff of our faith. They were the chosen race, the ones that rejected Jesus. They said, Jesus, we're not going to let you be Lord. Have you let him be Lord of your life? Do you obey him? Have you believed the gospel? Do you recognize you can't save yourself through human effort, religion, trying really hard, or I'm just going to be a better person? None of that holds water. Do you recognize you're a sinner? You needed to receive a righteousness that wasn't your own, came from Jesus, living the perfect life, showing what life with God looks like, going to the cross, taking our sin, giving us his righteousness, rising again, ruling and reigning in heaven until his second coming. Have you believed that? Have you practiced belief in that? It's a question you need to answer this morning. If you